Not a witch hunt today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. If confirmed as Attorney General, William Barr would oversee Robert Mueller's Russia probe. Today on Capitol Hill, Barr said, A, it's not a witch hunt. B, he won't interfere with it.
And on my watch, Bob will be allowed to finish his work.
Also, author Seth Hatena says Trump's Russia connections go back decades. But he says the biggest question for Mueller is still this one.
Did Trump collude with Russia during the campaign? We need a definitive answer to that.
Plus, we go back to a Pennsylvania town that went big for Trump in 2016. 2.5 years later, people there still worry about jobs leaving the U.S.
You keep getting things made overseas and people don't have high-paying jobs over here. Who's going to buy the damn product?
The stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. William Barr answered questions on Capitol Hill today.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you affirm that the testimony you're about to give to this committee will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God.
I do.
Barr is President Trump's pick to be the next attorney general. He's likely to be confirmed, but this is someone with views on the Russia investigation that are the complete opposite of Donald Trump's. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham cut to the chase today with these two questions for Barr.
Do you believe Mr. Mueller would be involved in a witch hunt against anybody?
I don't believe Mr. Mueller would be involved in a witch hunt.
Do you believe that Attorney General Sessions had a conflict because he worked on the Trump campaign?
I'm not sure of all the facts, but I think he probably did the right thing recusing himself.
The Russia investigation began well over 2 years ago. What's left to do, and how's this story going to end? Seth Hatena, you spent a long time looking at Trump's ties with Russia for your book about that history. It looks like Barr is going to be the next attorney general. What's that going to mean for the Russia investigation?
Well, you know, he said under oath now that he intends to let Mueller finish his investigation into collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia.
On my watch, Bob will be allowed to finish his work.
The troubling note is that he did write a memo before he was nominated.
I wrote the memo as a former attorney general who has often weighed in on legal issues of public importance. And I
saying that he basically objected to an obstruction of justice investigation into the president. But I was thinking about this, and it seems that if anyone would have been a more troubling nominee or more likely to let Trump off the hook, it would have been Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and he did the opposite.
Were you surprised by some of Barr's answers?
I was pleased. I'm pleased to see that he respects the law. And, you know, he knows Bob Mueller. They worked together in the past. And Bob Mueller is a man of great integrity, and I think he respects that.
So the confirmation hearings continue into tomorrow. Will you be looking out for anything in particular?
I would like to see him answer questions about his obstruction of justice memo in particular. That seems a bit troubling to me.
And remind us what he said in that memo.
What he said was that he thought that the president or any other official can commit obstruction of justice in the classic sense of sabotaging a truth-finding function. But he seemed to think that it wasn't an appropriate focus of Mr. Mueller's investigation.
Barr addressed the memo in his opening statement and said that it was kind of a very specific topic that he was addressing.
My memo was narrow, explaining my thinking on a specific obstruction of justice theory under a single statute. The memo did not address or in any other way question the special counsel's core investigation into Russian efforts to interfere in the election.
Did that satisfy you, or do you think there's more there?
I think the basic question is whether it satisfies the Democrats on the committee. You know, Chuck Schumer and Mark Warner of Virginia, you know, they've basically called for Barr to rescind his nomination, and we'll see whether that answer satisfies them.
Does it feel to you, Seth, that Mueller is almost done with his investigation?
You know, this has become like a great Washington parlor game where everybody
right.
tries to predict where Mueller is going to go. The way I see Bob Mueller's investigation, it's like a submarine, and periodically it surfaces, and we don't know how it got to where it is from where we last saw it. But, you know, I think Bob Mueller is proceeding very methodically, and I think he's watching these hearings right now to see whether the ground rules are going to change for him.
What do you mean by that? What might change?
Well, you know, I think Mueller is very mindful that he's operating in a political environment that is changing right now. I'm wondering whether Barr is signaling to Mueller what he wants the shape of the report to be by saying that obstruction of justice may not be worthy of consideration, that he wants Mueller to focus on the collusion angle.
As you know, over the weekend, two big news reports, one in the New York Times that said Trump had been under investigation by the FBI since 2017, shortly after he fired James Comey, and then another in the Washington Post that said Trump went to great lengths to conceal what happened in his meetings with Vladimir Putin. So as someone who's followed Trump and his Russia connections for a long time, did you hear anything new in those reports in the Times and the Post?
So, you know, there's some kind of cognitive flaw in the human mind, I think, that we need anonymous sources and newspapers to tell us things that we've been seeing all along. You don't have to be a great detective to see that Trump has been cozying up to Putin for years before he even started running for president. He's been involved with Russians in his projects for decades. So, you know, we're just getting a picture, a mosaic that is getting filled in bit by bit, and the picture is becoming clearer and clearer as we go. The problem may be here that the idea that a president may have conspired with Russia is too momentous and too frightening a prospect for most people to comprehend, and it may take the American public a long time to come to grips with it.
What is the craziest thing that you learned in your research, or has like the craziest stuff emerged since Donald Trump went into the White House in 2017?
Well, crazy in Donald Trump. You know, to me, the most fascinating stuff was that this has been going on since the 1980s. And he was literally palling around with Russian criminals. They were in his Trump Tower. They were in his casinos. He was backslapping with these guys. I mean, he was made no pretense about being friendly with these types of people. And, you know, the stories that I came across from FBI and prosecutors about the mob connections that trace their way to Trump are unbelievable.
Both Russian mob and Sicilian mob. I have to ask you this, though, Seth. Did Trump know about those mob connections at the time? I mean, because if you look at the Trump story in a certain way, he kind of is almost like the Forrest Gump of U.S. history, just happened to be there. Maybe he did know, maybe he didn't know what was going on. But suppose he just happened to be there and didn't know. Is that a possibility?
Here's the way I look at this. There's a great quote from Ian Fleming. He says that once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, and three times is enemy action. That these coincidences happen over and over in Trump's life. If it was a one-time thing, I'd agree with you. Yeah. But this is a mistake that Trump made so many times, it seems impossible to think it's mere coincidence. You know, Trump Soho, which is a building in Lower Manhattan, according to my reporting, was literally financed and developed by Russian criminal money. And there's no way that the entire project can be run that way without Trump knowing about it.
Seth Hetena, the author of Trump Russia, A Definitive History, thanks very much for being with us, and thanks for the update on the William Barr hearings.
Thanks, Marco.
Before the Russia investigation, back when President Trump was candidate Trump, he paid a visit to the small city of Manesson, Pennsylvania. It's a former steel town about an hour's drive south of Pittsburgh. Trump made some bold promises while he was there.
This wave of globalization has wiped out totally our middle class. It doesn't have to be this way. We can turn it around, and we can turn it around fast.
That message went over well. Trump easily carried the county south of Pittsburgh. During the summer of 2016, we sent the world's Jason Margolis to Manesson to talk with people there about Trump's promises. This past week, Jason went back to hear what people there are thinking now.
Downtown Manesson is literally crumbling. Hundreds of buildings are boarded up or missing windows. One guy I passed on the street said, "Welcome to Hiroshima." The population here has fallen by nearly two-thirds since the city's heyday. There used to be 9 elementary schools. Today, there's 1. With this backdrop in 2016, then-Mayor Lou Mavrakis invited presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump to come visit.
What else could I do? I was desperate.
Only Trump came. Manesson has been solidly Democratic since President Kennedy visited the old steel town back in 1962. But Trump siphoned off a lot of votes. He carried the county easily, though he didn't actually win the Manesson vote. Mavrakis, who is a Democrat, freely admits nothing has improved here since Trump came to town. The former mayor said back in 2016 he knew Trump couldn't bring back the old steel mills. Still, Mavrakis isn't angry with Trump for promising the world.
Well, naturally, all politicians do that. You know, I'm 81 years old. I've been through a lot of elections. You hear a lot of promises, and they're all false. They'll say anything to get elected. That's the American way.
Mavrikas adds, it's not like Trump's failure is unique. He says Republicans and Democrats have been ignoring the problems in communities like Manassas since the 1980s.
Nothing has happened. This place didn't deteriorate overnight.
Mavrikas says he was disgusted with both presidential candidates.
I voted for myself. I wasted my vote.
Manassas still has plenty of nice homes, parks, and ample space. Mavrikas asks, why not invest more in America's dying industrial towns while we still can?
What is wrong with that idea? Yet this country could give billions of dollars to countries that hate us, and you can't take care of the very communities that built this country? It's ridiculous. I mean, come on. It's going to come back and bite them in the ass. You know why? You keep getting things made overseas and people don't have high-paying jobs over here. Who's going to buy the damn product?
That anger in places like Manassas helped get Trump elected. But now some of that anger is turned on President Trump. Jackie Elias says the president has been peddling false hope, and worse.
Why is he not bringing his manufacturing back to the United States so more people will have jobs? And his daughter with all the lucrative contracts from China? That doesn't make sense to me. How are you going to make other people bring business in here when you won't even bring your own businesses back to the United States?
Elias, a retired special education teacher, says her frustration goes beyond unfulfilled promises. She says the president has set a dangerous mood in the country.
People are attacking each other. I mean, it's like road rage 10,000 over.
That spilled into Manassas. In 2017, voters elected a 26-year-old high school band teacher as their new mayor. Since Matt Schirra took office, things have turned ugly here. Schirra began his term investigating alleged ethics violations by the previous city council and mayor. Schirra says he's been harassed and threatened to stop his work at City Hall.
And then they changed the alarm system code so that I can't enter the building. So,
a city council member also publicly urged people to go to Mayor Schirra's home with pitchforks and hogtie him. Schirra hasn't attended a city council meeting since last May, and you thought Washington was dysfunctional. Now, obviously, President Trump isn't involved with the local political scene in Manassas, but Schirra says the commander-in-chief has set a tone.
He's kind of leading by example where people feel that it's okay to do these kinds of things and throw protocol and ethics out the window entirely, and in some cases, legality out the window.
Still, a lot of people here view the president quite differently. Billy Hands is a contractor and lifelong Democrat.
I voted for Trump.
I asked Hands about Trump's promises to help Manassas or the Mon Valley.
I think he got more issues to worry about than the Mon Valley. That's what I think. I couldn't tell you much about that, but I just think he has too much on his plate to worry about what goes on in the Rust Belt here.
Overall, though, Hands says he's happy with the president.
He's trying to get the wall, but the Democrats are stopping that, and mainly it's Pelosi and Schumer. That's my opinion. You've seen the caravans coming and the immigrants jumping over the fence and everything like that on TV. That's crazy. It's crazy. And then they come in and they take jobs away from people.
Keep in mind, Pennsylvania voted for the Democratic presidential candidate in every election going back to Bill Clinton in 1992. Trump carried the state by 44,000 votes. It was people like Hands, Democrats, who helped put Trump in the White House. Some here haven't forgiven former Mayor Lou Mavrikas, again a Democrat, for inviting Trump to their city. They felt Trump used their struggling community as a backdrop for touting unrealistic plans that could never materialize. I asked Mavrikas if he regrets his invitation.
No, I don't have no regrets. What did anybody else do for us? Nobody's done nothing for this community for 28, 30 years. Whenever you're in my situation, what would you do? I'd ask you the same damn questions. Would you say, don't come here, Trump? Don't come here, Hillary Clinton? We're going to continue to die on a vine the way we are? I'm trying to do something.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Manassas, Pennsylvania.
This podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to our podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics with far-reaching implications, from how venture capital is fueling innovation, to the global shift toward renewable energy, to the economic impacts of President Trump's legislative agenda, and more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Peter Henkett is a Dutch photographer known for shooting celebrities like Lady Gaga. But a couple of years ago, he found himself at a photo shoot on a barren strip of land in the Republic of Congo.
Let's go up top and see, because I can also shoot from there and just have a...
Henkett
really
is staging a scene. Dozens of Congolese kids are lining up in a dried riverbed, almost like they're about to play leapfrog. The photo that came from that shoot is one of dozens in a new fine art photo book called Congo Tales, told by the people of Mbomo. Proceeds from the book, as well as a photo exhibit and a film, will all go to helping the Mbomo people and protecting the Congo Basin, the world's second largest rainforest after the Amazon. The project also raises some difficult questions, starting with this one. Is it appropriate to bring together the world of glitzy art photography and the poverty-stricken lives of real people living in a place like Congo?
How could we juxtapose two worlds that normally don't function together, and how could we find a way to make them function together for a cause?
That's Dutch film producer Eva Vonk. She and French Congolese artist Kovo Nsonde are part of the Congo Tales project. Vonk says they started by going to the villages around Mbomo and asking about local fables.
Slowly but surely, they started to deliver handwritten notepads filled with old mythologies and fables. And with these, we eventually ended up working together with Kovo for the adaptation of these stories, and also working towards creating a more complete sense also of these stories.
Yes, and other tales from my own family background, because my father is a storyteller and an artist, so I grew up with these some of these tales which are in the book. People are aware of the importance of the preservation of their culture, of our culture, to give the Congolese people and the whole world the real dimension of these tales. My aim was to give each tale the power and the deepness it deserves.
Some of the villagers actually sang these fables to you. I want us to hear one from the pygmy village of Oleme, a few miles from Mbomo. This is the story of the fruit.
The woman singing, she's the main storyteller of Oleme. It's an allegory, because this fruit is not only a fruit. In this fruit, there are symbolism and magic.
Eva, you and your team came up with the idea of taking the portraits of the villagers of Mbomo as they were acting out these proverbs or myths or fables, and you were using large format cameras, studio backdrops. Why this approach?
I didn't come up with, wow, if we don't document these stories now, they will perish. It came to me when I was there once, and there was a lightning storm, and there was a tree that got hit by thunder. It fell down and all the people around it gathered and they started telling stories, because apparently the tree was very important because it was next to one of the former huts of one of the founders of Mbomo. And these stories and how they were told eventually came to this quote that when an old person dies, here, it's as if it's a library of stories burns away. It was such a beautiful moment of how these people all gathered and started telling these stories. And from this quote, this inspiration really came. It's like, okay, how can we work together? How can we document these stories? What would be an interesting way?
I saw the quality and I think in myself, yes, these people want to do it with the maximum of quality, technical, but also human. So I said to myself, okay, I will trust these people and I will go with them in Congo. For me, it was the first time in my life I've been in Congo, in my country with so much white people, but it was wonderful.
I want to come back to that in a moment, but let's talk a bit more about some of the photographs, because one of the most powerful is of two boys, one playing the role of the mole and the other the sun.
Ça c'est le soleil. Et ça c'est le top. Maman est top déjà ça couffa.
Yeah, le top and le soleil, the mole and the sun. One of the boys recounting that fable there. As high quality as the work is, and as sincere as your intent was, Eva Vonk, it was your idea. You presented this idea, we'll have you dramatize these fables in photographs. Do you think they were really in any position to say, no, we don't like that idea?
I spent a lot of time there, and the idea didn't just occur to me, say... I went once, came back and decided, let's bring a fashion photographer or a celebrity photographer and ask these people to enact their stories. I really tried to kind of listen and understand the stories, and then came to this conclusion of what do we use this platform for when we take these pictures with this specific technology. We usually use this for selling things or commercializing things or making someone that is famous even more famous in sense. So it's really been a team effort. So I don't think that it was so much imposed as to a collaboration.
It's important to underline that, of course, people are aware of the necessity to preserve their own culture, that they don't wait for the rise of white person with technology to do so.
It does sound, though, like some of the villagers thought you were all a bit crazy when you proposed this idea, this, like, you kind of said, a white European idea. Am I right?
I had many times that I thought, wow, 100 women in a line with a fire torch? Are they going to come? Are they going to want to do that? And then eventually 150 women showed up, happy to make this part of this one story, to kind of document it. It became bigger and bigger. And then when we came back, of course, to give the Lingala version of the book, there we really got also this feedback that, wow, we thought you were crazy, but there's a book now and we read the stories in the book and kids want to go to school so they are able to read also the stories in the book.
Right. Here's the mayor of Mboma looking at the photos for what appears to be the very first time.
C'est vraiment magnifique. Nous, on croyait pas. On voyait que c'était des petits trucs.
That's the mayor of Mboma looking at the photographs and describing them as magnificent.
Eva and I grew up in this culture. I studied this and of course, I learned about the tales from Northern Congo, but it was a lot of trust and a lot of responsibility for me when to find Bokaka Bwanga, one of the storytellers there. He allowed me to make an adaptation of the story of his grandfather. When we went back to show the exhibition to Mbomo, I print the adaptation, I gave it to him, and I remember he read silently what I wrote, and after he said to me, "C'est bon." Oh,
yeah.
And but it was like a lot of trust, a lot of responsibility. It's right.
Yeah, I think I just want to add something to that about collaboration, because there's two worlds that are coming together. And the question there is if they can be. And I think the way we worked, they could. It wasn't one party really very much telling the other party how to do that, but it was really, how are we going to do this together?
The project and photo book is Congo Tales. Steve Regis Kovonsonde is a Congolese artist and philosopher, and Eva Vonk is a Dutch film producer and the book's editor, just two of the many people behind the photo book and education project Congo Tales.
Okay, let's do the smoke. We got this picture. Let's do some smoke real quick.
Kovo, Eva, thank you very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
Okay, we got it. That's it. Fini. Merci.
To read one of those Congo fables, it's called The Mole and Sun. Come to us on the web. That's also where you can see some of Peter Hankett's photos at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman.
Every day that passes without this issue being resolved means more uncertainty, more bitterness, and more rancor.
You can say that again. Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan was roundly rejected by Parliament today. That leaves Britain's exit from the European Union in limbo. Latest on Brexit, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It is being described as a humiliating defeat for British Prime Minister Theresa May. Her plan for the UK's exit from the European Union was put to a vote in Parliament today, and it was overwhelmingly rejected by lawmakers, which leaves a lot of things up in the air for Brexit, for May, and for Britain in general. Here's Theresa May speaking right after her plan's defeat in Parliament.
Every day that passes without this issue being resolved means more uncertainty, more bitterness, and more rancour. The government has heard what the House has said tonight. But I ask members on all sides of the House to listen to the British people who want this issue settled and to work with the government to do just that.
The World's Orla Barry in London has been following today's events. So, Orla, how bad a defeat was this?
It was humiliating is one word, unprecedented is another. I just saw some interesting statistics go up on a website about the votes that prime ministers had lost over the years. Not since 1918, they said, did a government lose a motion so, so badly. This really is unprecedented. I mean, throughout the day, Marco, we've been listening to people talking about how many votes she might get and how many she might lose, etc. And they talked in the figures of, you know, if she lost 100, this is what it would mean. If she lost 150, this is what it would mean. If 200 voted against her motion, this is what it would mean. At 230, no one thought it would be so big. It has to be said, there really is a huge amount of shock amongst all MPs. And I don't know if you heard the moment that the vote happened and that they called out the result, but there was a huge gasp in the chamber.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432.
Yeah, that is extraordinary. 432 to 202. So what now for Brexit? How will it be settled?
Well, ain't that a question? If I had the answer for you, Marco, I would be up there in Parliament at the moment. So first off, let's talk about the short term. In the short term, we have a motion of no confidence in the government. So the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, this evening, once Theresa May stood up and said her little spiel after the vote was announced and had been lost, she acknowledged that there would likely be a vote of no confidence from the opposition party. And indeed, there was.
Her governing principle of delay and denial has reached the end of the line. She cannot seriously believe that after 2 years of failure, she is capable of negotiating a good deal for the people of this country. The most important issue facing us is that the government has lost the confidence of this House and this country. I therefore, Mr. Speaker, inform you I have now tabled a motion of no confidence in this government.
So they are going to table a vote of no confidence, and a debate on that will happen tomorrow. At this point, by the way, all indications are the government will get through the vote of no confidence without too much difficulty. Mm. So in a sense, you know, it's optics by the opposition party, but it's kind of delaying tactics at the same time. And some Conservatives and Theresa May's own party may well say to themselves, this gives us a little bit of a chance to take a breath, because they know that they probably will get through on this, but they still have to go back to the bigger question, which, as you say, is Brexit. What happens now with Brexit?
Will there be another kind of attempt by May to create another deal before March 29th? Or is that the day when there's a hard Brexit, no deal, and the UK has to leave the European Union?
Well, indications are that here is a woman who is strong-minded, who is stoic, who is dogged and determined. And if she can get her deal through, she will do it by hook or by crook. So there is a sense that she will likely come back with another deal. Whether the EU can offer something that MPs will be happier about. We've seen some EU leaders, you know, saying this evening that what is the UK government to do? We've done all we can do, etc. But, you know, at this point, nobody wants, and this is from all sides of the political parties, no one wants it to be a no-deal scenario. So indications are is that she will go back. The difficulty is, if she has had so many MPs voting against her, how can she get those 232 MPs to some form of consensus on some of the issues that are proving so difficult, and then return to Brussels and say, this is what our MPs might vote in favour of. I mean, her hand is considerably weakened this evening, and it's considerably weakened going back to Brussels. So Brussels will wonder, well, you know, we respect you and all of that, but clearly you have a difficulty within your own party. So that's the first thing. Will she go back? Many indicate that she will come back. May not be once, but twice more. March 29th is the big date. That's the date that Britain is due to leave the EU. There are indications that the EU may allow Britain to extend that date so that Britain doesn't have to leave at the end of March. And that would certainly give more breathing space as regards the kind of the time needed to try and get a deal agreed.
The World's Orla Barry speaking with us from our studios at the BBC in London. Orla, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Just as we were coming into the newsroom this morning, we got some awful news out of Nairobi, Kenya. Suspected militants attacked a building with a hotel and restaurants. Several people were killed. The terrorist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. This afternoon, Kenya's interior minister said the situation was under control. Emily Johnson is a reporter in Nairobi. She was at the scene earlier today as the attack was still unfolding.
There were still gunshots that were audible from my spot about a block away. And we heard one loud blast, which we learned was a car bomb that went off. And people were coming out little by little to be greeted by very emotional loved ones.
Thank you, Jesus! Thank you, Jesus!
So, yeah, it was a pretty tense scene.
I've seen several reports of loud blasts. Was there more than one car bomb?
It sounds like there were a couple of initial car bombs when the attack began. And then later, when I had arrived on the scene, I heard another blast that was confirmed as a car bomb.
Describe this hotel the attackers targeted. It's called the Dusit. Is it well known?
It is. And it's not just a hotel. This complex is home to a number of buildings where various businesses are located, NGOs, Qatar Airways, I&M Bank, restaurants. So it's not just the hotel itself, but it sounds as if the majority of people who were trapped were in the hotel.
So you spoke about people emerging very emotional. Did you speak to anyone in the crowd while they were waiting for news of what was happening inside this complex?
Yes, I spoke with several people, an American guy who's waiting for his girlfriend, various Kenyan people who were waiting for loved ones to come out. They were understandably upset. I spoke with one man, Jeffrey Tumbo, who was working in maintenance at the nearby Riverside Apartments. From where he was located, he actually saw what he believed were some of the attackers going in.
All of a sudden, we just had boom, and everything went. The cars in alarm, people were tensed. Even one of the tenants, she couldn't eat, she couldn't pick the phone, she was shaking. It really affected people.
This isn't confirmed, but there had been some reports that a suspect had been apprehended, and Jeffrey said he had been there and witnessed the apprehension of the suspect.
The militant group Al-Shabaab, which had ties in Somalia and has spread loosely across East Africa, Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. Do you have any other details about their intent? And is it clear that the claim of responsibility did in fact come from legitimate agents of Shabaab?
Well, Reuters reported that it was a spokesman of Shabaab who made this claim, so it seems legitimate. And the timing of it seems interesting. This attack comes 3 years after 100 Kenyan soldiers, KDF soldiers, were killed by al-Shabaab in an attack in Somalia. It also comes shortly before a verdict is expected in the trial of men who were charged in aiding the al-Shabaab attack on Westgate Mall in Nairobi 5 years ago.
Right. That was a major al-Shabaab attack in 2013. 70 people died. The standoff even dragged on for a couple of days. Do you think today's attack, though, reminded Kenyans of this fragile existence between them and al-Shabaab?
Definitely. There's certainly been a lot of emotional and passionate appeals saying, you know, we need to get out of Somalia. We need to stop this from happening again.
I think this is really senseless. Whoever is behind this, we must condemn it in the strongest terms possible. We're not going to be cowed. We won't be cowed, because if we're cowed, then they defeat us.
Wow. Emily, it sounds like a lot of people out on the street were shaken by this attack today.
Definitely very shaken. And as I was on my way to the scene, traffic getting away from it was unbelievable. People in Nairobi, they don't mess around with this kind of stuff. You know, they've seen it before.
Reporter Emily Johnson in Nairobi updating us on the attack at a luxury hotel, an attack claimed by al-Shabaab. The International Criminal Court at The Hague announced today that it has acquitted the former president of Ivory Coast. Laurent Gbagbo was charged 8 years ago with crimes against humanity. The allegations stemmed from his disputed election in 2010. Unrest that followed the vote left 3,000 people dead and 500,000 people displaced in Ivory Coast. But today in The Hague, Gbagbo supporters cheered and celebrated his acquittal. My BBC colleague Anna Holligan was outside the court when the ICC announced its verdict.
Laurent Gbagbo has always had a lot of support, a lot of people who are willing to travel here to support him as he battles to clear his name. I met his daughter, Marie, earlier, and she said, well, this is a vindication. We always knew he was innocent. And they have been very loyal in their attendance. I was sitting in the public gallery as the judge delivered his decision earlier, next to a man who threw his fist in the air. They were cheering. throwing victory signs, so much so, in fact, that the judge had to ask people to calm down, otherwise he would have to evacuate the court. But of course, there has been so much talk, as there always is, when we talk about the ICC, about how damaging this has been to the court's credibility. And I think it's really important for us to set out the kind of different arms, because it's the ICC, but it's the prosecution that came on in for so much criticism today. Failure after failure after failure, the judges outlined. They said they'd failed to provide the evidence. They'd failed to demonstrate that there was any kind of state or organizational involvement in the alleged crimes. Anyway, there are a lot of people who are saying, well, actually, this is a very good day for international justice, because it shows justice isn't always about finding people guilty. If people are innocent, or if the evidence hasn't been presented, then they must be acquitted. And that's exactly what happened here at the ICC today.
The BBC's Anna Holligan at the International Criminal Court in The Hague today. Meanwhile, in Ivory Coast, largest city of Abidjan, the court ruling was celebrated by some, and others were angered, especially victims of the violence that followed the 2010 election. I asked Valerie Boni with the BBC's Africa Service what some Ivorians think Gbagbo is guilty of.
A lot of people say Laurent Gbagbo attacked, for example, women in a market in Abobo. It was a case of the ICC, or said, gives an order to kill some people. But it's difficult to know if he really said that, or if it's only his supporter who did it. And this is, I think, the problem of the ICC.
What are Ivorians saying today about the legitimacy of the ICC?
For the supporter of Laurent Gbagbo, it's the justice now that the ICC say he can be free, because, of course, they support him. But for other people, they say even if a lot of African president and African person are in the ICC, they still believe in the neutrality of the ICC.
Really? They believe in the neutrality? Because if you go down the list of people who are indicted by the ICC, it's almost all Africans. Is there a sense that the ICC has it in for Africa?
A lot of people say, yes, it's only about African people. But if this person, if they don't face the justice in their own country, nobody will talk about what happened to the victims.
And the victims in this case being some 3,000 people and their families who are still alive.
Yes, and today the victims are very, very angry by the decision of the ICC. For them, the ICC denies the justice to them. It's like they are the sacrifice of the crisis. And they are very angry. Some of them were crying. And it was very difficult for them to hear this decision.
Are Ivorians expecting to see Gbagbo soon? What's supposed to happen to him now?
It's difficult to say, because Laurent Gbagbo was condemned here at 20 years of prison. So,
Vale, you said he was sentenced to 20 years in prison in Ivory Coast already.
Yes. So if he come back here, he can go to jail. We don't know how the government will react if Laurent Gbagbo arrives.
Why is Laurent Gbagbo so important to his supporters? What does he symbolize to them?
For them, it's Laurent Gbagbo, for his supporter, is like the president who supports the poor people, will do things for poor people, and is Pan-Africanist too, and is a big symbol for them. And when Laurent Gbagbo was sent to jail, it was a really big shock for their supporter. And since then, they say they cannot have a reconciliation in Ivory Coast if Laurent Gbagbo is not there.
That's Valerie Boni with the BBC's Africa Service speaking from Abidjan, Ivory Coast, with reaction to the International Criminal Court acquitting former President Laurent Gbagbo. Just ahead, a federal judge decides that the citizenship question has no place on the 2020 census. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Putting a question about citizenship status on the 2020 census is unlawful. That's what a federal judge in New York decided today. Judge Jesse Furman of the U.S. District Court in Manhattan said the move by the Trump administration to ask about citizenship on the census was egregious, and it adds up to a, quote, veritable smorgasbord of violations. Brianne Garaud is the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. It wrote a friend of the court brief on this case. Garaud says the citizenship question was dropped from the census decades ago for good reason.
In 1960, the federal government stopped asking a citizenship question of all people who fill out the census form, because there was real reason to think and real evidence that including this question would really deter some members of our community from participating in the census, and that in turn could result in inaccurate numbers. The census is only taken once every 10 years. There's no do-over.
What are those groups you were just referring to?
The concern is that those who are immigrants, who live with immigrants, will be nervous about responding to a census that asks about citizenship, particularly at this moment in time when there have been so many efforts by the Trump administration to take action that are harmful to the immigrant community.
What exactly did federal Judge Furman conclude? What was the argument that you felt was most relevant?
He said that the addition of a citizenship question violates the Administrative Procedure Act in a number of different ways. The Commerce Department has been delegated authority by Congress to administer the census. And so it was Secretary Ross's decision to add this question. He needed to do it in a manner that was consistent with federal law. And that was what Judge Furman concluded that he failed to do. He gave a reason for adding it that the judge concluded was pretextual. In other words, Secretary Ross didn't give his real reason for deciding to add this question to the census. These are Judge Furman's words. The fair and orderly administration of the census is one of the Secretary of Commerce's most important duties.
Right. I mean, your organization, the Constitutional Accountability Center, called the census a cornerstone of our democracy.
That's right. It was a critically important part of the framers' design that our democracy be premised in the idea that all persons, no matter where they're from, regardless of whether they can vote, deserve equal representation in our government. And that's why they mandated the federal government count all people living in the United States, citizens or non-citizens. And that's exactly what the census should be doing.
So what Judge Furman decided today, that doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be a question about citizenship on the 2020 census, right? There's going to be an appeal now.
I mean, I think that's very likely. What Judge Furman said is that he thinks the addition of this question violates the law. But I think it would be incredibly surprising if the Department of Justice did not appeal this decision. And so we'll likely see action in the Court of Appeals and potentially at the Supreme Court in the very near term, because the census needs to be finalizing the question so that it can administer the questionnaires and take this count next year.
Brianne Gourad, the chief counsel at the Constitutional Accountability Center, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I've got our reporter Rupa Shenoy in the studio with me. Hey, Rupa.
Hi, Marco. I'm here to tell you about stories I have running on Wednesday and Thursday.
Yeah, I'm really excited to hear this. This show, The World, is about obviously the world, and it's about America's place in it. And in that sense, these stories that you're about to give us might be the most world stories ever.
I think so. This year, 2019, marks 400 years since the English colonies entered the international slave trade. This is an industry with a huge, horrible legacy. It was the biggest forced migration in the history of the world. And the world is still dealing with the fallout. But a lot of people only know about this history through movies.
Suppose they pass a law taking away your liberty, making you a slave.
That ain't a supposable case.
Laws change, Epps. Universal truths are constant.
Could you take Django there and take him around the grounds here and show him all the pretty stuff?
As you please, be there.
Django isn't a slave.
Your Honor, here are the true owners of these slaves.
Those were moments from In Order, 12 Years a Slave, Django Unchained, and Amistad.
Movies might give you a sense that we know a lot about what enslaved people experienced or who they were. But once you start to dig down and you try and get to specifics, you realize there isn't much there. Like when we try to understand who the first enslaved Africans were and what happened to them.
So set the scene for us, Rupa. What was happening in 1619?
You have to keep in mind that in 1619, Portuguese and Spanish were dominating the industry at that point.
And the English got involved at some point then too, right?
Right, but not in 1619. That's the point where Spanish and Portuguese actually claimed a monopoly on the international slave trade.
So how did the first enslaved Africans end up in the English colonies?
It's an interesting story, and we only really know about it because a lot of the records around the world of things like shipping receipts have been digitized in the last few years. Mm. And so people are piecing stuff together. What we know is that the first enslaved Africans to arrive in the English colonies originally came from what is now Angola. They had European names like Anthony, Isabella, William. Those were given to them by Catholic missionaries. And at some point, they were taken and they were forced to march 100 miles or more to the coast. And they were loaded onto a ship called the San Juan Bautista.
And where were they headed?
The colonies in Mexico. And they were almost there when they were overtaken by pirates.
Pirates, so maybe English pirates, perhaps?
Right. I actually talked to an expert on this, Boston University professor John Thornton.
Pirates are, you know, they're thieves that happen to live on sea. But what we're actually talking about is what is politely called privateering.
And remind us what privateering is.
Privateering is where a government gives private vessels permission to steal from other countries' ships. And it was actually really popular at the time.
So the San Juan Bautista, the ship gets overtaken by these pirate ships.
Yeah. And now because of Thornton, we know who those ships were. He identified the two of them. One was called the White Lion. The other was the Treasurer. And he discovered most of the captains and the crew were English. Thornton published an article on this in 2006.
Which, amazingly enough, was published 9 months after the day I finished typing it. It was really, shall we say, it was hot.
And apparently that's a really quick turnaround. English pirates took about 40 Africans off the San Juan Bautista and went to Virginia and sold them.
In Virginia, in Jamestown?
Good question. Because we're still dealing with holes in history, there's some debate, especially among local Virginians.
People ask me, why is the landing so important? And I tell them that to me, it's like your birth. You can only be born one time. Nobody can change that fact to fit their propaganda or marketing or promotion or tourism needs.
And that's tomorrow's story.
I really look forward to these stories tomorrow and Thursday, Rupa. Thanks very much for setting it up.
Thank you.
And that's where we're going to leave things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks very much for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.